And now we're going to switch focus to another story that's been developing over several weeks now. How did the claim that Iraq was trying to buy nuclear material in Africa make its way into the president's State of the Union address last January? It's widespread knowledge now that the allegation was based on a forgery. Yesterday, Stephen Hadley, a deputy national security advisor, took the blame for allowing misinformation about Iraq's nuclear intentions into the president's speech. In today's Washington Post, Dana Milbank and Walter Pincus offer new details about Stephen Hadley and his involvement with this controversy. And joining us now to give us a timeline of these events is Dana Milbank, a reporter at the Washington Post. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, Neil.
How and when did Stephen Hadley first find out that the information about this alleged attempt to buy uranium, that was misleading?
Well, as Stephen Hadley himself said yesterday, we still don't know exactly, and he left the door wide open that we'd learn more things about this than we did already. What we knew before yesterday was that CIA Director George Tenet called Hadley at some point on October 5th, 6th, or 7th to tell him not to have in the president's important speech in Cincinnati on October 7th a reference to these attempts to purchase uranium in Africa. Now, the White House had earlier said that this is really, he had a technical difference over the source of who it would be attributed to, or exactly what the amount of the uranium was. Now, what we learned yesterday is that, in fact, Hadley, Condi Rice, others in the White House had received two memos from the CIA, one on the 5th of October and one on the 6th of October. It was about many things in the speech, but in each one listed very substantial objections to any claim about uranium in Africa being in the speech. So these were reacting to drafts of this October 7th speech that had a reference to the uranium in Africa. Mm-hmm. So clearly the White House was made aware of this at a much higher level than they had earlier acknowledged.
So this is definitely a change in the White House explanation of what happened. But how do they explain what happened next? They didn't make reference to it in that speech that was delivered in Cincinnati, yet it reappears again in the State of the Union.
It reappeared in the State of the Union. It reappeared in an op-ed in the New York Times that Condoleezza Rice wrote, reappeared in a December 19th State Department fact sheet as part of the presentation to the United Nations. It's very strange because this particular allegation, the government saying, well, nobody was particularly pushing this allegation, and the CIA and others have disputed it and said it at the very best, it's not a very significant allegation. And yet this allegation repeatedly was made front and center in major presidential speeches and in a variety of other public forum by the administration.
Mr. Hadley yesterday took the hit. He has offered to resign for his error. He said, "I failed to remember this." Does that seem credible to you?
It's hard for us to judge at this point. What did not seem credible earlier is when George Tenet took the fall, 10 days ago or so, was saying, look, it's my fault. My agency did not properly vet the speech. That didn't sound right. Now we have the deputy national security advisor saying, look, it's my fault. But the fact of the matter is the national security advisor and the president both had copies of this national intelligence estimate, which expressed significant doubts about this evidence from the State Department. The National Security Advisor also had these memos. So the question remains, first of all, whether Condoleezza Rice will bear any responsibility here, and also the President of the United States and everybody saying, look, he was just blameless. He believed what he was reading in the speech was accurate. And that may well be true, but it's also true that he was earlier looking at drafts of speech that had that allegation in them and later had to have known that that allegation was removed.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's take a question from Daniel, who's with us from Kent, Ohio.
Hi, Neil. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a simple question. I would just like to know, I keep hearing about these forged documents, and who forged them, and who else would benefit besides our administration by doing so?
Dana?
Well, it's a question that does not have an answer yet. Certainly, we have not been able to discover it in the media, and the government says they don't have the answer to that yet. Whoever did the forgery didn't do it particularly well. There were the officials misidentified, other obvious errors of fact. This was as soon as this was handed over, I believe it was early March, to the International Atomic Energy Agency. They immediately knew they were forgeries. The government said it did not actually have these forged documents in its hand until right about when it handed them over in March. In fact, the Post learned that several months before, in fact, they did have these documents in their possession. So nobody's made an allegation that that somebody on our side has cooked these up. But on the other hand, nobody has a very reasonable explanation.
In the New Yorker magazine, it was reported that these were a part of a British black program of disinformation. Is there any evidence to support that?
Well, I'm sure that this is probably the Cy Hirsch piece, so
yes.
I'm sure there's some evidence there. Earlier it had been attributed saying we got them from the Italians. The Italians denied that. There's a whole lot of confusion going on about these documents now, and the administration has said, well, at any rate, they had reason to believe from U.S. intelligence that they were attempted uranium purchases in Somalia and other African countries. On the other hand, those allegations were also just as disputed as the Niger ones.
And is I assume that you and many others in the media are trying to pursue the question of where those the origin of those forged documents?
Sure, I'm keeping my eye on the White House, but obviously people here are pursuing all angles of this particular story. I mean, the more interesting thing now is each bit of information comes out from the administration, it seems to contradict earlier explanations, which of course makes us look out for further revelations yet to come.
We're speaking with reporter Dana Milbank of the Washington Post. Daniel, thanks very much for your phone call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Dana, as you say, these stories, it continues to unravel after the situation yesterday. The president expressed his confidence in Mr. Hadley and has said, as far as he is concerned, the matter is closed. As you suggest, there are questions about his own responsibility, and eventually the buck has to stop somewhere. The famous sign on Harry Truman's desk has been referred to many times on this, and also Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, will be asked questions about this. It seems a long way from being over.
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, the administration right from the beginning was saying, we've dealt with this, it's time to move on. It's interesting, they were using the very same words that the Clinton administration was using during its troubles with scandal as well. So it's only natural that they would say that. The fact is, what's driving this is not just this matter. Nobody particularly knows where Niger is or understands what yellowcake uranium is. So what's driving this is a frustration among the public that's very easy to see about events in Iraq not going terribly well, with deaths of American soldiers, the appearance of chaos there, the inability to discover any weapons of mass destruction or to find Saddam Hussein. So that's why people are saying, wait a second, how did we get into this war in the first place? And that's what's fueling the Democratic presidential candidates, other Democrats, and any others who would ask questions about this. And I think it's quite clear that if weapons of mass destruction are found, if Saddam Hussein is captured or killed, if the threat to American soldiers is reduced in Iraq, this question will go away pretty quickly. It will become one of academic interest, but the public will no longer care.
And at the same time, as you're talking about this specific example of the yellow cake from Niger and this forged document, this has come to symbolize the whole raft of questions about the alleged manipulation of intelligence before the war.
Well, it has, because the administration stated with absolute certainty that that Iraq had a very serious weapons program and, in fact, had large stocks of chemical and biological weapons and was very close to producing a nuclear weapon. Now, whatever may yet be found in Iraq, it's quite clear that that suggestion is not true. It was the whatever weapons they have were not close to a position of being used, and they're obviously not in the quantities that it had been said they were in.
You talked of frustration, perhaps, in the public. Here's perhaps an example of it, an email we've got from Deborah Valoff in Oakland. I think it's a little too convenient that now, she writes, a week or more after this controversy began, as the heat is being raised on Bush and calls for an independent investigation and impeachment are gaining momentum, the NSC assistant to Rice just happens to come out with a story that he was the one responsible for not passing on the information. Seems like that he, like Tenet, is taking it like a man and falling on his sword to protect an inherently corrupt administration.
Well, look, there's no question that Steve Hadley is falling on his sword. I can't say much about the corruption in the administration generally, but it is clear, it is interesting, the timing of making this revelation they made yesterday. It was on the day that Hussein's two sons were killed, the day that Jessica Lynch returned to her hometown. It was a good news day for Iraq. It was a good time to slip out some bad information. What we also know is that hours before they made this disclosure, the CIA alerted to the White House to the presence of this memo. So you could sort of detect almost an implicit threat in there. The CIA is saying, look, we have it in writing that we fought this allegation about the uranium, and you continue to use it. So there could conceivably have been a concern of, well, this is going to leak and get out, so we might as well say it.
Dana Milbank, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Dana Milbank, a staff reporter at The Washington Post, and he was speaking to us from the Post's offices here in Washington, D.C. Coming up, we'll talk to two people who both worked in previous White House administrations, one for President Reagan, the other for President Clinton, and hear their opinion about the process described by Stephen Hadley yesterday. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the role of President Bush's Deputy National Security Advisor, Stephen Hadley, in letting misinformation get into the president's State of the Union address. To give us some perspective on this story, we've asked two people to join us who've been inside the White House and inside the National Security Council. If you have questions about the process and how it works, give us a phone call. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address, TOTN@NPR.org. Joining us now from Edwards, Colorado, is Richard Allen. He served as President Reagan's first National Security Advisor, and as we just learned, he was a Deputy National Security Advisor to President Nixon. Good to have you back on the program.
Thank you.
And also with us, James Steinberg from the Brookings Institution here in Washington, where he's Vice President and Director of Foreign Policy Studies. He was Deputy National Security Advisor to President Clinton, and welcome to you.
Good to be here, Neil.
Richard Allen, let us begin with you. What's your reaction to the description of this story, as we just heard from Dana Milbank?
Well, it's a fabulously interesting story. It's one that's going to go on and on. It's reached the point at which it may be impossible ever to determine what actually happened. I was fascinated by the Pincus and Milbank story, and it recalled numerous examples where or several examples, in which bad or inadequate information found its way all the way to the top. One thing I would say, however, right off the bat, and I don't mean to introduce a political angle to this, but that to compare this with the slow revelations that are coming out now as a result of either mistakes or other activities, with the revelations under the Clinton administration, is only a superficial comparison. It's not a very good one, and I wish that Mr. Milbank would still be on so we could talk about that.
Okay. Well, James Steinberg, a question of process. It in this story, it's identified as the Deputy National Security Advisor's job to, at least part of the job, I'm sure there's plenty of other things he does, to vet the president's speeches for exactly this kind of thing.
Well, Neil, I think it's easy to sort of single out this one specific part of the process, but I think what we're looking at is a broader problem that manifests itself in this one expression. I think there's been a back and forth between the policymakers and the administration who have been unsatisfied with the way parts of the intelligence community were performing, wanting more forward-leaning statements, wanting to get more. And I think it's in that climate that this problem arose. And it's not simply a question of this one foul-up of the process, which clearly fouled up, but really a bigger problem of a process that was badly broken.
And Richard Allen, what he's talking about there is these allegations that there was a lot of pressure on the CIA to come up with information that would support the administration's case for war against Iraq.
Well, that may or may not be true. In my view, you face a constant battle. Mr. Steinberg may have faced the same situation with leaks from the void, which may frequently be traced to the agency or elsewhere in the government. There's a good ex post facto case with 20/20 hindsight to be made that a lot of things should have been received more attention, that the facts should have been verified. But I think it's very important to recognize that the Central Intelligence Agency has a stake in this. I can think of several cases in which, let me say, I won't use the word prevaricate, but I will say several cases in which administrations which I have served were badly misled by the agency, either by covert action and by commission or by omission. And there are several cases that come to mind as far back as the Nixon administration, and I think the Carter administration fell victim to this. I know certainly we did in 1981. So there is a very unhealthy track record concerning the veracity and the reliability of the Central Intelligence Agency. That is not to shift the blame back on them, because the process on this will unravel and more facts, as Mr. Milbank pointed out, will become known. But we have to factor in the absolute and undisputable fact that that agency, among others, will mislead either by underinforming or by simply abstaining.
I was fascinated, James Steinberg, with the last thing that Dana Milbank was talking about, the White House hearing from the CIA that, hey, we have a copy of the memo we sent you. Is this a form of bureaucratic blackmail?
I don't think it's a form of bureaucratic blackmail. I think it's an attempt to keep the discourse honest. And I think that it is important that this be straight. There have been calls for a review of this. I think the intelligence committees ought to take a look at it. But as I say, it needs to be in the broader context, that we need to understand better about what the interaction was between the policy community and the intelligence community. I think it's important to remember, Neil, that it wasn't just the president who was talking about Iraq's nuclear program. The vice president talked on a number of occasions, at one point said that Iraq had reconstituted its nuclear program, said at another occasion it was reconstituting it. And so this information and this approach to the problem was something that was going on throughout the administration and not just a question of this single speech.
One thing I might add to what Mr. Steinberg said, it's an interesting question that occurred to me over these last days. If this was repeatedly mentioned in speeches, in fact sheets, although it didn't appear in the Cincinnati speech, but of course in the State of the Union speech, why haven't we heard more objections from the bowels of the bureaucracy about the misuse of what was clearly in the minds of some, so now we think, a forged document? I'm wondering why it takes this most recent process and the fixation on 16 words to elicit the fact that the bad information was used.
And James Steinberg, I put that same question in a way to Dana Milbank. In a way, this particular allegation, because there's a forged document to hang on to, has become the symbol, the icon of this whole set of charges of political manipulation of intelligence.
Well, as you may remember, Neil, a number of weeks ago, a group of former intelligence community officials did come forward and made some statements about what they felt was the pressure on them. So I think this debate has been underway, and not only with respect to the nuclear program, but I think there's been some serious questioning of some of the claims about the links between Saddam and al-Qaeda as well. And I think there was some public discussion and some concerns from the intelligence community about that. It's very difficult. You know, we ask these people to keep their oath of confidentiality and secret, so they're not going to go to the press and be public, and that's what we want for them to do. What we need to understand better was whether there were internal complaints about this or internal expressions of concern.
May I also point out that there always is the issue of conscience, and there is always, as Mr. Steinberg knows, the option of simply leaving, and some people have done that.
Mm-hmm.
Very hard to evaluate whether that's done for ideological purposes or whether it's done for purposes of fact. I might say that leaving, of course, the leavers never win the argument.
The other day we had David Gergen on the program, who serves in several administrations, and one of the questions we asked was whether, to his knowledge, there had ever been an administration where charges of political manipulations of intelligence had not arisen, and he said no, that it comes up in every administration.
Well, what can one say to that except amen?
Let's get some listeners involved. Our number again, 800-989-8255, and let's begin with Ken, who's on the line with us from Lighthouse Point in Florida.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I'm wondering, am I right in thinking that both Tenet and Condi's guy there, they're both falling essentially on different sides of the same sword?
Condi's guy being Mr. Hadley, yes.
I'm sorry, yes. And it just seems as though someone's credibility is worth nothing now. My own mind, both. But it just seems as though Tenet admitted something that now everybody's just jumping all over the place to admit the same thing. I'm exaggerating. And I'll be happy to take any response offline other than just to add my personal belief that they're all a bunch of lying thieves.
Okay, Ken, thanks very much for the call. James Steinberg?
I think that, you know, as I say, it's easy to point fingers at individuals. It's clear that the CIA as a whole did send out a number of warning signs. I think that George Tenet has taken responsibility because he personally didn't review the speech. Maybe he should have done that. But it's not obvious to me that the CIA did fall down on their job here. If, in fact, they had warned officials at the NSC about this, then that is taking the responsibilities that they should do. I think the other big question, though, that does have to be looked at is that in this national intelligence estimate, which was the most important kind of formal assessment of the state of Iraq's weapons program, there that concern about the allegation about the Nigerian uranium didn't seem to get the kind of attention that it deserved. And I think that may have contributed here to the overall problem.
Could that not also have been a result of the fact that it was mostly contained in a footnote in a very large document?
Go
ahead.
I think that I'm not only a veteran of the NSC, but also of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, and I think that it's a very important function that that Bureau plays, is sometimes giving an alternative view, and I think that it's important that those things not just be dismissed as merely a footnote.
I didn't suggest they were dismissed. I suggest that I suspect that while doing your own job in the Clinton White House, you might have also been pressed for time. This is not a feeble excuse, but pressed for time, and not bothered to read some of the footnotes, because if you came from the State Department, you'd know that the wall-to-wall footnotes and objections and exceptions that take place in the interagency department, departmental process, sometimes blurs the mind. It's very easy to miss facts. You should be careful. You have the obligation to be careful, especially when words ultimately go into the mouth of the President of the United States, whom, incidentally, I say is blameless in answer to the question in this regard. And you have to be extra careful to make sure you vet all your facts, but it never happens with 100% perfection.
I think that's right. I think Dr. Allen's absolutely right. But I think it's also true that on matters that are this important, that the failure to reflect in the body of the document the fact that there were parts of the intelligence community that had doubts about it made it harder for the policymakers to make the judgment that ultimately it's their responsibility to make.
We're speaking with James Steinberg, a former deputy national security advisor to President Clinton, and Richard Allen, who was President Reagan's first national security advisor. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller. Tom joins us on the line from Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'd like to know about the congressional angle on this, what the Senate and House Intelligence Committees knew about this, and whether or not the White House is able to control the flow of information there. And if that's true, how can they possibly make an informed decision and be a co-equal branch of government if they're given poor information that's altered by the White House?
Does that come into it, James Steinberg?
Well, it's certainly an important channel, and the responsibility of the Director of Central Intelligence is not only to the President, but also to the two intelligence committees in Congress. He's supposed to report directly to them. The statute is very clear on that. So there should be no reason for the White House to interfere or to be in the line, as it were, between the committees and the CIA. I think it's important to understand what the committees knew. I think they're in the process of reviewing that now, but I would certainly consider it an absolute responsibility of the Director of Central Intelligence to give the straight story to them as well.
I might add that the congressional committees are becoming more important. They didn't exist forever, and those the congressional committees on intelligence have gained in importance over the years, particularly in the last 20 years.
Okay, Tom, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And see if we get one more caller in. Dave is on the line from Los Angeles.
Hi, thank you. Stripped down to its simplest features, it looks like the administration was pressuring people to give them information. They had the knowledge that what they were saying was a lie. They were lying in order to give an excuse to go to war. Thousands of Iraqis and hundreds of Americans died as a result, and it's costing us at least $4 billion a month now. What are the consequences for these people for lying? A, in the case of the president, is it an impeachable offense? And B, in the case of other administration officials, what is the consequences for lying, or is it okay to lie if powerful people are asking you to?
Dave, that may be your conclusion, but it's yet unclear as to who may have lied or that anybody may have lied in this controversy.
If it's shown that they've lied, what are the consequences for people for lying, given the costs?
That's a fair question. Richard Allen?
Well, I think that whatever processes need to run will run their course. I think it's ridiculous in this case to speak of impeachment of the president on an issue of this type. I would continue to insist that the president has a right to rely on that what is given to him. How it reaches his desk and finds its way into a speech of his is something that can be discovered, but as I said earlier, I believe that at this point we're in such a miasma of facts. The end zone is flooded with facts and countercharges that it's going to be extremely difficult. However, this president, in my view, is utterly blameless in that regard.
James Steinberg, the president says this matter is closed. Evidently, it is not. But how serious do you think it is?
I think what's important, Neil, is that we're facing a new world where the kinds of threats that we face are very shadowy, they're very uncertain, and intelligence is going to play a bigger and bigger role in our making decisions about when to go to war and when not to go to war. We've been talking a lot about preemption and the idea that we have to deal with threats before they fully emerge. So how we assess that intelligence and how we talk about it becomes more important than ever, and I think that's why people are so concerned about this, not because of whether there was a particular failure on a particular 16 words, but rather what's the obligation of an administration in this new world in terms of how it talks about these new threats.
And we're going to have to leave it there. I'm afraid we're out of time. But James Steinberg, thank you very much.
Thank you, Neil.
James Steinberg, Deputy National Security Advisor to President Clinton, joined us from the Brookings Institution in Washington, where he serves as Vice President and Director of Foreign Policy Studies. Richard Allen, always a pleasure to have you on the program.
It's nice to be here. Thank you.
Richard Allen, National Security Advisor to President Reagan and Deputy National Security Advisor to President Nixon. He was on the line with us from Edwards, Colorado. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.